Whoa, buddy. Put that thing back in its holster. We haven't gone anywhere.
I don't understand.
Check out the MichaelDukesShow.com for information on how to get access to the podcast.
Hi, how are you? Wow, it is Monday. It was a train wreck this morning. What the actual hell is going on? I don't know. This stuff has been working flawlessly for like a month, and then this morning, oh, ain't nothing working. Ain't nothing working. Errors and everything else, and then reboot that takes 5 minutes, and I just wanted to come on and talk to you this morning, and nothing was cooperating. So, good morning, and thanks for coming in and joining us. It is the Michael Duke Show, your home for common sense, liberty-based, free-thinking thought and discussion. Today's show is going to be a little abbreviated because, unfortunately, I've got a recording session at about 10 minutes after 11. That I had already scheduled. Otherwise, I'd just run a full 2 hours now. But I got other things to do this morning, unfortunately. So we're going to be about 90 minutes here of good commonsensical discussion. This is the new time. I know! This is like, I mean, come on! I got up, I was ready, had all my coffee, was feeling great. Nothing worked. Oh, man, technology, you got to love it. Which, ironically, is some of our discussions this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the darker side of this technology that we all seem to be embracing more and more and become dependent on. Obviously, this is actually kind of ironic. And I'm moving to Oregon. Yes, I am moving to Oregon as well. So, sorry, that's an inside joke for friends of Brad Keithley, who wasn't Mia Costello. Who was it? It was Kathy Geisel. That said, Brad's numbers are all wrong. Icer sucks. And Brad Keithley, by the way, took all his money and moved to Oregon. Which, of course, none of that's true. But, you know, don't let that stop you. Just don't let that stop you. All right. So we're rocking and rolling now. Finally. I should have just restarted from the... That was my problem. I kept trying to fight it. And I should have just rebooted from the very beginning. We would have been started 10 minutes late instead of 25 minutes late. All right. So what's happening on the program? All right. I just said we're going to talk about technology. We're going to talk about some of the darker sides and potentially downsides to all this new technology that we are embracing in our daily lives. We're also going to talk a little bit about the dollar. And we're going to talk about the dollar and inflation and everything that's going on in the United States. I mean, we've seen what's gone on here in the state of Alaska. And as I've said many, many times, that is just a microcosm, a snapshot, a pale imitation of what's going on at the national level here in the United States. And so we're going to talk about that this morning as well. So, Ed, Craig, Heather, Jeff, James, David, Rhonda, and more all joining us in the chat room. I appreciate you all coming in here. Do us a favor, will you? Hit the share button. Hit the share button. And by the way, if you go to MichaelDukeShow.com, you have to like the page, but you also, I've discovered in doing some reading and some other things, you also have to click on the... I can't remember what it's called now. I just lost my train of thought. It is the page or the thing that basically says show this first. right? Show posts from this thing first. So you got to like the page, and then you got to go to the following page, and it says in your news feed, and then you have to hit see first instead of the default setting. Because if you just see the default setting, you'll only catch about, I guess, 1 in 4 or 5 posts that I put up. And I don't put up a bunch of posts a day. I post twice a day. One is when the live show starts. That's a post. Then I post the podcast afterwards. That's a second post. And then I may post one interesting news story or one interesting commentary piece throughout the day. So I might have 3 posts a day, 2 of which are the actual show, 1 in video form, 1 in audio form. And the problem is, my wife and I were talking about this yesterday. She's like, I like your show. I love your show. I've liked it on Facebook. But I don't always see when you go live. I might get that first notification, but if I miss it, that's it. So make sure, again, you like the page, and then you go to the little thing here, and let me show you. This is another page that I like. Right here where it says, right here where it says following. See that? You have to click the see it first. So you go to like, you like the page, and then you go to the following, and then you click see it first, and then, apparently, according to my reading and research, then I should pretty much come up in your feed with every post that I have. And again, I'm not spamming your feed. I have like 3 posts a day. One is the live show, one is when I post the audio podcast, and maybe a story, maybe 2 in a day that are stories or commentaries or something like that that I really like. So just so you can see what's going on and understand and be part of it. So I would ask that you share the show. You also like the show page because you probably have already, but also that you use that see first option under the following tab on my page. All right. So that's all the housekeeping this morning that I have. You can find the podcast up on my website, michaeldukeshow.com. You can also find him on TuneIn Radio and iTunes and the Google Play Store and so many other places. So just follow those around. If you got an iPhone, it's really the easiest if you've got, I hate to say that because I'm not a fan of the Apple iPhone, but if you've got an iPhone, it's the easiest way to find me. Just go to your iTunes, look under podcasts, type in my name. That's it. Pretty simple, pretty easy. Check it out. All right. Anything you guys want to talk about this morning is fine. If you want to throw some things out there in this first hour, I want to talk a little bit about, I am so scattered this morning. So technology, the depreciation of the dollar and potential problems with inflation. And finally, in the next hour, we're going to talk to Todd Smolden, who you may be familiar with. His name was dropped in the hat when it came time to appoint a replacement for Senator Mike Dunleavy. He was suggested and made it to the short list for the replacement for Senate seat E, and he was subsequently denied because I think he took a pretty hard stance against some of Governor Walker's policies. And that obviously doesn't endear you to a position that is an appointed position by the governor. So that's okay. That's okay. But he has been vociferous in his discussion and his talking points about everything that's happening in Juneau. What's been going on? He's been writing opinion pieces and doing radio interviews and things like that. I guess he hosted Amy's Dymbosky show a couple times. So he's over there doing that. And I wanted him on the program because he recently wrote a piece for Must Read Alaska talking about SB 26. And he mentions pretty intently a couple of Hammond's principles. And he actually mentions diapering the devil and talking about that, which I thought was a very good piece in Must Read Alaska. In fact, I should just throw it out there. Let me just throw it out there into the chat room so that you guys can read it before we get into the next hour. Maybe you could take a quick break here during our discussion and you can you can read it and see what your thoughts are on it. I thought it was a very good piece, and we're going to have Todd on in hour two. We're going to finish out the show with him to discuss it. excuse me. All right. Now, let's talk about technology. If you've been listening to this program for very long, you would understand that I love technology. I am whatever the opposite of a Luddite is, that's what I am. I embrace technology. I love it. I find it fascinating. I think it's interesting to try and figure out how to integrate new pieces of tech or ideas or concepts into my life. And I've always been fascinated by that. We were just talking the other day with my kids, and we had them all in the room, and I looked around and I realized because we were talking about technology and kind of the immersiveness and millennials versus Gen X and everything else. And I said to my daughter, you know, we read the definition of millennials according to Wikipedia and iGen. My kids are actually part of the my kids are not millennials. They're kind of, one of them is. But the other one is the other four are essentially what they call the Gen Z or iGen, which is the generation that is so adapt and used to technology. I mean, they have not known a world without the internet. Just think about that for a second. I remember having my first internet connection, dial-up at our apartment. My wife and I had our apartment, had our first child. We're waiting on the birth of our second child, and I literally looked at my second child, who's now 20, almost 21, and I said to her, I just realized that we had internet before you were born. That I literally was playing a video game with a friend over the internet the night she was born. That was, Terry was sitting, I was in our room, I had a little desk in our room, a little corner desk where I did work, and I had a computer, our only computer set up. I mean, think about that, our only computer. Our only computer cost five times what a high-end PC costs today, and it was 166 megahertz. My phone is eight times faster than that. But anyway, I mean, it's hysterical to think about. But I was sitting there playing a game over the internet with a friend while Terry was laying on the bed. We were waiting for the baby to come. It felt like it was getting close. And boom, Terry's water breaks right there while I'm playing. And I'm like, gotta go. See you later. But that's hysterical. You think about that. That is hysterical. That all of our kids have never been unaware of the internet. I mean, even my oldest daughter, Riley, she was very, very young when we got the internet, probably five years old. I mean, she was very young. And so really, she, even as a millennial, has not been unaware of the internet. It permeates our daily lives. I remember back in Fairbanks, and this must have been 7, 8, 9 years ago, when there was some kind of major malfunction between Fairbanks and Anchorage on some kind of construction project or something. Some backhoe or whatever cut the major fiber optic cable between Fairbanks and Anchorage. And I had a phone, and I used my phone quite a bit, but I wasn't married to my phone. I wasn't dependent. And I remember I was sitting at, well, this shows you how long ago it was. It was when there was actually a Chili's in Fairbanks. Remember that? Before that went downhill. I remember I was having lunch with a client or a coworker at Chili's, and I'm looking around, and I swear to God, people were just, I mean, they'd pick up their phone, and they'd look at it, and is it back yet? Does it work yet? I can't see it. It doesn't, they were panicking. It was like they had become so dependent on their cell phones for every bit of whatever that was going on. They were just flustered and panicking. And although I was inconvenienced by the inability to use the phone or make, to me, I was ambivalent about it, even though I really love technology. I have done my best to try and not make sure that technology doesn't ruin my run my life. So there's pros and cons to this, and we've talked about a lot of it. Now, as we move further afield in the tech tree and we start doing more and more things, I think that there's some definite possibilities for some great things to happen. And what I mean by that is talking about like whole home automation, the Internet of Things, all this stuff coming together, everything being tied together. I find it a fascinating thought experiment. I think this is going to be a very, very interesting time as these things get hashed out. But what I've done is I've made a decision. I don't want to be the guinea pig on these things. Because one of the greatest security risks these days is the Internet of Things, right? I mean, hackers are everywhere. Hackers are everywhere. And the idea that your home network is probably pretty secure compared to, you know, a lot of, I mean, as long as you're smart about it, your home network is fairly secure from Wi-Fi intrusion and other things. But what they've discovered is that all these IoT devices, and what those are, Internet of Things, it is the smart devices. It is your smart refrigerator, your smart toaster, your smart microwave, your smart TV. All these things that have got smart in the title are all basically wired to a whole home network in one form or another. And what they've discovered is that these are the soft points in your armor, so to speak. I mean, if your router is your shield, it's your main bastion against intrusion, wireless intrusion, and other things by outside actors, both from the internet and wirelessly from your neighborhood, then what you're seeing is that all these IoT devices are your soft and squishy points that nobody can see, because they're finding that those signals can be interrupted. They can be hacked. There's no encryption on most of these devices. And they can tunnel through these devices into your home Wi-Fi network, which opens up a whole other problem of intrusion, identity theft, just, you know, muckery that can happen in that thing. So I have been very cautious. I want to be a user. I want to be a whole home, IoT home network user where I could turn my lights on and off and do all this stuff and tell Alexa to, you know, to dim my, I want to be able to do all that. I really do. But that being said, I don't feel like being the guinea pig. And right now I just don't feel like that most of these technologies are advanced enough. I mean, from a technical standpoint, they're advanced enough to protect, to do things, to do tasks and all this other kind of stuff. But the security technology, in my opinion, has just not advanced far enough to catch up with everything else. If you're just joining us, we're talking a little bit this morning about the darker side of technology and you know, that we use and embrace on a daily basis. I know people, you know, you want to talk about politics and things like that. We're going to get into that here in a little bit. This is something I've been wanting to talk about. So, and if you want comments or if you want to talk about something else, just throw it up in the chat room there. You guys are being awfully quiet this morning. And that's usually a sign that I'm not on a topic that you guys really care about. So, but this is where I'm at. This is what I'm talking about. And this really is kind of what spurred this whole conversation, though. I've been thinking about talking about this topic for a while. And then I saw this story this morning or late last night. From Drudge. Again, I love technology. I would love to embrace it, but I don't want to be the beta tester. I don't want to be the guinea pig on these things. And then I see a couple different stories. One is a new lawsuit or a continuing expanding lawsuit that has been brought against Facebook by a California startup called 643. 643 has put together this legal brief, and they've been suing Facebook now for the last couple of years. It's been an ongoing court battle. But they are now alleging through expanded discovery that Facebook uses its apps to gather information about their users and their friends, including some who have not signed up for Facebook, that it reads their text messages, that it tracks their locations, whether they want them to or not, and accesses photos on their phones, including photos that have not been posted to Facebook. This is, again, more of the discussion about this fraudulent, you know, this mass surveillance thing that we've got going on. It is the weaponization of data that Facebook has been trying to do, because in this information age, data is power. Who you are, what your habits are, what your interests are, all the things you do online, all of that is data that can help manipulate you and your buying habits. And so that's what Facebook has been doing. But if these claims are even halfway true, and this is just the latest round after the Cambridge Analytica hack and all that kind of stuff that you saw that they took information on millions of Facebook users, this is very, very kind of spooky. It alleges that Facebook used a range of methods, some adapted to the different phones that users carried, to collect information. Facebook continued to explore and implement ways to track users' location, to track and read their text, to access and record their microphones on their phones, to track and monitor their usage of competitive apps on their phones, and to track and monitor their calls. But it turns out that we can't see all of this because the details in this court brief have been redacted on Facebook's request. Facebook claims that these are confidential business matters. So they got them redacted and sealed by the court for a period of time. So they have until next Tuesday to submit a claim to the court for the documents to remain in sealed from public view. But I mean, there's some damning. If I got to tell you, if they have to have those pieces, those documents sealed, that really just makes you think, doesn't it? The lawsuit, by the way, claims that Facebook lured developers and investors onto the platform by intentionally misleading them about data controls and privacy settings. As part of the filings back in January, 643 claims Facebook tracked users extensively, sometimes without consent. On Android phones, they were able to collect metadata and content from text messages. On iPhones, it could access most photos, including those that had not been uploaded to Facebook. Others alleged projects included one to remotely activate Bluetooth, allowing the company to pinpoint a user's location without them explicitly agreeing to it. And finally, the most damning one to me was involved the development of privacy settings with an early end date that was not flagged to users, which means the users did not know that the privacy agreement and privacy settings would expire and they would revert. So they would expire without notice and then all your privacy settings would change. That's some seriously damning stuff. And so, you know, we're broadcasting on Facebook today, but I do get very, very, very concerned about what is going on with our social media and when they have so much power in these areas. That very well concerns me. Then we get into the issue of Amazon Alexa, right? I mean, we've all seen the Alexa device, right? It's the, you know, it's the fancy little fancy schmancy speaker in the puck size or the tower size that's part of this IoT thing that we talk about. I mean, it is the smart home hub. You talk to it. It does things for you. You can ask it questions. It is the voice-controlled smart speaker that basically does it all. And this is what we're hearing about. Google has their home device. Apple has got, what is it, Siri? Or I can't remember what it's called. Same kind of thing. Everybody, every major player, Amazon, Apple, Google, they and Samsung, I think, too, they all have their own home device speaker system that talks to you, that connects to everything, and does all this. But here is the problem, especially with the advent of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence and what they call artificial machine learning. It can do a lot of things. Again, discovering your habits and things like that. And most of that information is not just staying in your home. It's being shared to the main companies, Amazon, Apple, you know, Google, those kind of things. They are sharing that data. I mean, it's part of your end user agreement when you buy those things, is that they'll share all your habits, from your music listening habits to probably to your settings on how hot you keep your home, to maybe how many times you have an argument with your spouse in the presence of your smart. I mean, you think I'm joking, but the analytics on these things are pretty intense. And then things got downright, damn right, Orwellian. A Portland family contacted Amazon to investigate after they say a private conversation in their home was recorded by Amazon's Alexa, that's the smart speaker, and that the recorded audio was sent to the phone of a random person in Seattle who's on the family's contact list. According to the wife, my husband and I would joke and say, I'd bet these devices are listening to what we're saying, but they quit joking about it when they discovered 2 weeks ago that their love for Alexa was about to come to a screeching halt. They received a phone call. The person on the other line said, unplug your Alexa device right now. You're being hacked. The person turned out to be one of her husband's employees who was calling from Seattle. She said, we unplugged all of them, and he proceeded to tell us that he had received audio files of recordings from inside our house. At first, my husband was like, no, you didn't. And then the recipient of the message said, you sat there talking about hardwood floors. And we said, oh my gosh, you really did hear us. I mean, just think about that. Your most private moments between just the two of you, or just between you and your family, the things that you would say to no one else, now potentially out there in the world. Now, they contacted Amazon, and they finally got an Alexa engineer to investigate. They said, our engineers went through your logs and they saw exactly what you told us. They saw exactly what you said happened and we're sorry. She said he apologized like 15 times in a matter of 30 minutes. And he said, we really appreciate you bringing this to our attention. This is something we need to fix. But she said he didn't provide any specifics about why it happened or if it's a widespread issue. So KIRO in Seattle reached out to Amazon and asked, what the hell is going on? Amazon says, Amazon takes privacy very seriously. We investigated what happened and determined that this was an extremely rare occurrence. We are taking steps to avoid this from happening in the future. Again, I don't want to be a guinea pig. I don't want people knowing what I tell my wife in the privacy of my own home. I mean, you know, I could be talking trash about anybody. Who knows? I mean, I love technology, but this is just some of the scariest stuff that you could see out there. So there is a dark side. I mean, again, between artificial machine learning, artificial intelligence, and this kind of invasion of privacy and everything else, this is an amazing time to be alive, but at the same time, it could be a very troubling time to be alive. And I'm just very concerned. The Bill Walker privacy settings, Harold says, yeah, that's pretty much it. We want to read everything you've ever written. James says, I have not succumbed to Facebook Messenger yet on my phone. Doesn't matter if you send it through Messenger or if you send it through the web browser settings on your phone. If you're using your phone for Facebook, either through Messenger or something else, they're still reading everything. They're still going to get everything. You got to figure that. I figure that if I put it on the internet, either through my Messenger or through, I figure it's there forever. It's there forever. Amazon or Apple still has better privacy than Google or Amazon. Still not great, but better. I would agree that Apple, but see, that's part and parcel of their business model because Apple's ecosystem is so integrated. It's built and locked down that's one of the reasons why they have a higher security in a lot of cases, but definitely not, you know, definitely not Fort Knox. Let's put it that way. Definitely not Fort Knox. Let's talk a little bit about the dollar here. We're going to jump into our discussion here in about 10 minutes with Todd Smolden. And so I definitely want to talk about that, but let's talk about what I consider to be a very important topic when you look at what's been going on in America overall and how that's trickling down to the states. And we've talked about that a lot, that what we're seeing in the various state governments in the way that they spend their money and how they do things is literally just monkey see, monkey do. It is a snapshot of what's going on in the United States. That's literally what we are looking at in the United States as a whole, and they're just kind of replicating that as they move forward. Simon Black, who is an investment advisor, he's got a website called Sovereign Man, and he talks a lot about protecting yourself from your assets, from the government, from diversifying and not putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. He's always a very fascinating read. And I would recommend that if you haven't checked out his website to at least peruse and see what his thoughts are, it would be an interesting afternoon of reading for you. Sovereignman.com. I posted this story a couple days ago. And put it up on my Facebook page, and it really makes you think. And we're going to talk specifically about what are the long-term challenges here in America. Obviously, debt, deficit, those are huge things. Those are absolutely huge. And Simon, he talks about that, and he also talks, of course, about the losses of freedoms over the years that we have experienced here in the United States and how dangerous and how tough that can be. But we're going to talk specifically about the destruction of the currency today. The Minted Coinage Act was signed into law. It was one of the first acts, really, that major pieces of legislation that happened in the United States. It formally created the U.S. dollar. Now, under that act, the U.S. dollar was defined as a particular amount of metal, precious metals, copper, silver, gold. It wasn't just a piece of paper that said, "In God we trust," right? It wasn't just what we call today fiat currency with really nothing backing it except the faith of the American people. A $10 gold eagle, for example, was 16 grams of pure gold, whereas 1 cent coin was 17.1 grams of copper. The ratios between gold, silver, and copper were all fixed. They were all one thing. But if we were to apply today's price of gold per troy ounce of $1,292 per troy ounce, we could see that the current value of the original dollar, as defined by the Mint and Coinage Act of 1792, would be roughly almost $67. $66.75 in today's money would be a single dollar in 1792. In other words, the dollar has lost 98%+ of its value since 1792. That's a devaluation and a destruction of the currency. It is a slow and steady grind of what has happened. Now, you don't notice it because it's subtle. It's incremental, you know? And we hear all about, you know, today's modern day bankers and people at the Fed and everybody else. They want to manage inflation. They want to keep it. They want to keep inflation low. They want to keep inflation at 2 to 3%. The problem is there's this thing called compounding interest. And Einstein said, you know, the only thing more powerful than the atomic bomb was compounding interest. And so when you get 2 to 3% per year and you add it up 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, now you're talking about a real number, right? Now you're talking about a huge number. And costs are going up. I mean, costs are going up. Black uses in his example, he talks about in 1982 when he was a toddler. God, I'm old. He said the price of a Ford Mustang was $6,572. And today, the cheapest Mustang costs $26,000. on Ford's website. $26,000 for the cheapest Mustang. When I was a kid, when I was born, a top-of-the-line Mustang cost $3,800. And today, it's top-of-the-line is $50,000. I mean, if you wanted the highest end, highest horsepower, most luxury package, everything else in 1969, it was about $3,800. Today, you're talking $50,000 for a Mustang of that kind of high end, biggest horsepower, everything you can get. I mean, that was 10 times as expensive, folks. 10, 15 times as expensive. The Labor Department shows that from 82, when he was a toddler, the average earnings was $309 per week, or $16,000 a year, roughly enough to buy 2.5 Mustangs in 1982 dollars. Today's earnings, it's $881 or $45,000 a week, but that's only enough to buy 1.78 Mustangs. So the average wages and earnings are going up, but your buying power is going down, right? You lost almost a whole Mustang there in your buying power. People's incomes have fallen 27.3% since 1982, but again, their wages increase. Their buying power has decreased. He talks about the housing issue as well, how, roughly you could buy 0.173 houses per year back in 2003, and today it's 1.39 houses per year, which is another 20% decline in your buying power in just 15 years. But see, here's the thing. All this inflation does add up, but all you hear about is that they want to manage the inflation. I mean, they've got a point to where they've discovered that inflation and keeping inflation exactly the same is actually official policy. I mean, they're trying to deliberately engineer inflation. Why? Why are they trying to deliberately engineer inflation? It's because the government debt is so huge. Think about it. They want to borrow $10 billion today. And they want to do it on a 30-year term. If they utilize inflation and they're able to inflate and devalue the currency, there will be as little as possible value in that currency. The same $10 billion will buy in 30 years. The purchasing power is down by 25 or 30% in 30 years. So they just saved, several billion dollars by deflating and destroying the currency. That's what they want to do. But see, it has another effect as well. Simon Black gets into this. It has another effect, and we could look at this at the effect of the American family. Back in the 50s and 60s, it was common for most families to be single-income families, right? Dad worked. They could afford a home, a car, all the modern technology, the brand new black and white TV. They could even have, maybe they had a summer cabin or they could go on vacations. They could do everything. They could do all of that on a single income. Today, both spouses have full-time jobs and they're barely making ends meet. I mean, they are barely making ends meet. Data from Pew Research showed that 70% of American households back in the 60s, in 1960, were single income. Today, 60% of households have both spouses working. And we routinely see how the average U.S. household has very little savings. Remember, we talked about this yesterday. 40% of Americans couldn't scrape together $400 for an emergency room visit. They have very little savings. They're loaded down with debt, and they're barely making it on two incomes. And this is all because they have been robbed of their purchasing and buying power by inflation. Think about that. Now, think about the effect that has on the family. Not just the children and the raising of children, but also on the stresses involved of both people working, being pulled in two different directions. Both of them so busy that they don't really have any time for each other. the money challenges that come along with this, and you wonder why the divorce rate in America sits somewhere around 50%. All of these things, folks, are intertied and pulled together. Right? That's all of these things are tied together. Don't think that they're not. We watch this, and I got to tell you, it is kind of a spooky situation to see everything that's going on with the dollar and how this is going to play out. I don't know how we're going to fix this. I truly don't. I was having this conversation yesterday with Brendan Berger, my former producer and best friend, and we were talking about what's going on in America, where things are going, and some of the solutions. We talked a little bit about the convention of states that people like Mark Levin are pushing. Mark Levin's one of the smartest men on the planet. I mean, I really believe that. But I believe that people who are embracing this idea of the convention of the states are also doing so with a very, very healthy dose of naivete. If you open up the Constitution for meddling, I think that that's the end of the republic, quite honestly. Would I love to see certain things, you know, changed or modified or tweaked? Sure, I think that there could be some tweaking in there to adapt for some of the things that we've got going on today. But the problem is that it's not going to be limited just to the smartest, brightest, libertarian thinking minds of our times. If you open up the Constitution to meddling, it's going to be the Barack Obamas. It's going to be the Pat Buchanans. It's going to be the Newt Gingriches of our time. And yes, the Mark Levins of our time, maybe the Ron Pauls of our time, but mostly those that have the power of the dollar to make a lot of those things happen. The Tides Foundation, the Soros Fund, you know, some of these other things. The Koch brothers only got so much money to throw at libertarian causes. And all these other things. I mean, I think they open up the Constitution in a convention of the states to fix what's wrong, quote unquote, or to rein in the power of the federal government, quote unquote. How many people in today's society are dependent on that very federal government? How many people in today's society have been taught from a very young age that the federal government is the answer, is the solution to their problems? Do you really think you're going to get a majority of the country to ratify, you know, something that would limit the power of their sugar daddy? Or would it be more likely that you would see a stripping and abrogation? You would see the Second Amendment stripped out. You would see components of the First Amendment stripped out. Hell, you might see components of the Fourth Amendment and others stripped out of there as well. Maybe you wouldn't be able to plead the Fifth anymore. They could compel you to testify, you know, under whatever, even if it did incriminate yourself. I mean, who knows what they could do? I believe that if they jumped into there and opened up that convention of the states, it would destroy us as a republic. Just as assuredly as what they're doing to the currency would do the same thing. So these are the discussions that Brennan and I are having. And I'm like, I don't know how to fix this because I don't see the political will to make it happen for all the reasons that I just mentioned. People who have become dependent on these things. And our discussion was, you know, our final, you know, kind of delineation was, well, maybe it just all has to burn. Maybe there's no fixing it. Maybe it just has to come unstuck and you have to walk back and pick up the pieces. Maybe that's what has to happen. I don't know. I'm sad, quite honestly, that this is kind of where we're at in this country, that we can't see the forest for the trees. It's kind of sad stuff. It bums me out. Bums me out. All right, we got more coming up. Let's jump into it. We've got Todd Smolden. He is joining us this morning. He is going to be talking with us about his brand new article, which I have posted up on the Facebook page. There in the chat room, you can check it out. It is it's an interesting read. It's on Must Read Alaska. Let's jump on board and talk with Todd and see what he has to say this morning on the Michael Duke Show. Let me get the phone call squared away here.
Streaming live every weekday morning on Facebook Live and MichaelDukesShow.com.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back. The Michael Duke Show, your home for common sense, liberty-based, free-thinking thought and discussion. We're about ready to jump into it here in just a second with a guy, you probably know the name. If you've been following politics at all, you probably heard it. His name is Todd Smolten, and he is a local Willow resident who earlier in the year threw his hat in the ring when Senator Mike Dunleavy stepped out of his seat to run for governor. And was promptly ignored by the governor. I don't know if ignored is the right word. Maybe just completely dissed, I think, is what my kids would say. He has been kind of following up on his political thoughts, doing things like radio and writing opinion pieces all around the South Central area and talking with folks about it. His most recent piece was covered in Must Read Alaska, Suzanne Downing's online blog, talking about the diapering of the devil. And SB 26, and as anybody who's listened to this program knows, we treat that volume as kind of the blueprint for where things should have gone with the PFD and more. Joining us right now on the phone is Todd Smolten. Todd, thanks so much for coming on board and talking with us today.
Well, thanks, Michael. It's my pleasure, and I have to say I miss you on that radio station that you used to be on, because it's hard for me to catch you on Facebook, but I'm sure glad you're doing your thing. And now that it's summertime, I will definitely be tuning in.
Well, so. let me throw some shameless self-promotion out there to say you can always download me on your iPhone through the podcasting app. That'll be fine. You can check it out there.
Hey, there you go. So,
but we will be back on the airwaves sometime here in the near future. I'm about just a couple weeks out from having my contractual stuff run out so that I can actually go back to work. So we'll be looking forward to that. But I really wanted to talk about this piece that you put up on Must Read. And you've written a few opinion pieces there and in other outlets, as I mentioned before. And what I really like about you is you kind of give the no-nonsense, position on this. Now, full disclosure, you're an economics teacher, so you've got kind of a grasp of how, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 and some of these other things that it seems like our politicians just don't have a full grasp on. So give us your rundown here and the gist of your opinion piece on what is going on with, you know, SB 26 and the way the legislature and the governor have treated the people and the private economy of the state of Alaska.
Well, yeah, and first of all, this is really more about philosophy than numbers, in my opinion. And I believe in my opinion pieces. I really try to write more about the philosophy and economic philosophy rather than numbers. But the numbers do really speak for themselves. I mean, in the last 3 years. The governor and the legislature have taken thousands of dollars from the average Alaskan family in the form of PFD cuts that are not even necessary, because the money just sits in the permanent fund earnings reserve account, and it doesn't stimulate the private economy. And it's a shame, and it's shameful, really. I mean, that's the bottom line. And while they're doing this, they continue to spin this narrative that somehow we're in a fiscal crisis. And what we're in is we're in a crisis of leadership. We're not really in a fiscal crisis. In fact, if you look at the total revenues taken in by the state last year, we actually had a surplus of revenue if you count the earnings of the permanent fund.
Well, and you look at that and you realize that they keep framing the argument in different ways. And what they frame it as a, as you just said, a revenue problem. And I've said this for years, Todd, we don't have a revenue problem in this state. What we have is a spending problem. It's not like somebody says, Michael, you know, you might have a thyroid problem or something. You're a little round and chubby. You might have it. No, I have a knife, fork, and spoon problem. That's my problem. Same thing that's going on in the legislature. They've got a spending problem.
An ice cream before you go to bed problem.
Right, exactly. I mean, but that's where we're at. They are addicted to the spending. Just look at the trajectory of the budget over the last 12 years. Compare it to the population, compare it to the adjusted growth of inflation and everything else, and we are way outstripping all of those factors when we look at the actual expenditures in the state budget on a per capita basis today.
Oh yeah, you don't. I mean, you don't have to do too much digging into some statistics to realize that since 2006, and granted, you know, we had a lot of revenue coming in. There were high, you know, high oil prices, but since 2006, the rate of the increase in the operating budget was more than twice the rate of inflation and population growth. And of course, when you spend like that, you also build special interest groups that are really difficult to cut when you need to. It's like, I kind of see it as like promising your, you know, you get a special contract or maybe you hit it really big and you're commissioned for 1 year and you start promising your children all these things and they think that it's going to happen on a yearly basis and then you lose some of your income. It's really difficult to dial that back and tell your children, you know, hey, no, we can't go to Disneyland this year. And
right.
And I'm sorry, but we can't get out so 3 nights a week. And that's really where we're at right now. But they don't want to say no. They have special interest groups that they're beholden to, and they're reluctant to say no.
Right. Well, and the irony of this situation is that these are monsters, so to speak, of their own creation. I mean, we've seen program after program become implemented, and the arguments against the program become, well, it's free money now, but maybe it won't be later. We may not have the money to pay for it down the road. And the answer, of course, always on the pro side is, oh, well, don't worry. If we don't have the money for it, we'll just shut the program down. Unfortunately, between 6 and 18 months later, all of a sudden, you've created a constituency that has become dependent on that program. So when the money does run out, and it always does, they say, well, we can't cut this program now. People are depending on it. You have created your own dependency situation. It is the proverbial self-licking ice cream cone.
Well, yeah, and let me give you a good example of that, and that is in Governor Walker's Medicaid expansion. When I interviewed for Senator Ruff, he doesn't call it his seat. It's actually Senate seat E, and I agree with him. But when I interviewed with the governor for that seat, he asked me, as an economics teacher, what would you do if you lost 80% of your revenue, which, first of all, we didn't lose 80% of our revenue, but I'll concede that point to him in the interview. And I said, well, I'll tell you what you don't want to do. What you don't want to do is you don't want to add new programs that are going to cost your state money.
Right.
And, of course, I'm guessing maybe that's why he didn't appoint me, because he didn't appreciate me calling him out on a Medicaid expansion for 20- and 30-year-olds just because, you know, they don't want to get two part-time jobs.
Right.
And so there you created a whole other constituency that's really difficult to say no to when you have to.
Right. And that happens time and time and time again. And then we have the businesses who've built an entire business model around government spending. They're private companies, but their largest contributors, their largest clients become the government. And so you have companies like GCI and others who, when the chips are down, start crying and saying, we need that dividend. You've got to keep the government solvent. You've got to keep these jobs rolling, because they built an entire business model around government largesse and government spending, and they can't make it in the private sector without that government spending. And so their answer is, of course, to take it from the people.
Right. And what we have is we have crony capitalists in our state and we have crony socialists in our state. And it's exactly as you said. And that's what I wrote about. Part of what I wrote about in my piece was the philosophical inconsistencies of these people who are voting to take the PFD. On the one hand, you have Republicans, so-called Republicans, who say they're fiscal conservatives. These are people in Senate leadership who take money out of the private sector and hold it back because they want to spend it for government.
Right.
And then you have the liberals, the Democrats, who claim that they're, you know, the champions of the poor, but yet they're more than willing to impose the greatest regressive income tax in the history of the state of Alaska.
Right. Well, and it's actually a twofold sword. I mean, the Republicans are bad because they'll say, we're your champions. We've drawn the line in the sands. We will defend you from attacks, while at the same time carving the largest tax possible out on the Alaskan people, which, of course, is taking of the dividend. And then the Democrats say, well, you just mean Republicans. We need this tax to spread it more evenly. So not only do they want to put a regressive income tax in, on top of that, they also approve a cutting of the dividend, which is then, again, one of the most harmful tax. I mean, ICER says that it has the largest impact on economic impact on Alaskan families. We're talking about taking $1 billion in effective money. You suck $600-700 million out of the economy. As it turns in the private economy, that's an effective $1 to $1.2 billion that you've sucked out 2 years in a row in an economy where the entire GDP of the state is about $40 billion. That's a significant amount of money.
Oh, yeah. Well, and after this October, it will be even more so.
Oh, yeah.
I got a little bit of pushback from a couple of people saying, well, where did you come up with your $20,000 for the average Alaska family? Now, I'm not using the average household's family in Alaska. What I'm thinking about is I'm thinking about the people in my community. I'm thinking about the PTA, the firefighter who his wife's a stay-at-home mom, who's the chair of the PTA. They just had their fourth child. That's going to be roughly $20,000 come this October that's been taken from them.
Right.
I'm thinking about my closest neighbors. I have one that's about a half a mile away and another about a mile or so. And he's a contractor and he does remodeling. He's getting less work and he has three children. I mean, this is, it's painful. And the sad thing is that it doesn't have to be,
right?
Because that money is just sitting there. Granted, it's collecting interest, but it should be working through the private economy. And the spin that somehow, we have to cut dividends to pay our bills, it's just nonsense.
Well, yeah, my favorite is, we're not going to pass a tax to pay your dividend. And I'm like, Jack, that money was ours to begin with. You never used to account for it the way that you do now as income and outflow. It was a simple pass-through, but all of a sudden you found this religion of we're going to count it as income, and now we have to count it as outgo, and we're certainly not going to do taxes to give you your PFD. I mean, it is really abhorrent the way that they have treated that.
Right. And, I guess this is in the last 2 years, what I have decided to do just as a private individual, school teacher, I've thought about, well, what can I do to make some changes in my state, some positive changes? And, I looked at what my skill set was, and my skill set is writing, and my skill set is motivating. And that's how I'm getting involved. And I guess I'm just going to, call people out here. This is not going to change if people just sit back and complain about it.
Right.
You have to look at what your skills are, how you can, contribute to a campaign. This is going to be a really exciting campaign season. I'm here to tell you, this is shaping up to be for political geeks. This is going to be a real fun one.
Right. Absolutely. Let me pick your brain for a minute as an economist for a couple things. First, I just mentioned it a minute ago that money turns in the private economy in a different way than it does in the public economy. I've seen different numbers from different entities, but roughly anytime you have a dollar that's turned by government, generally speaking, it turns less than one time. I've seen the numbers from 0.6 up to 0.9, but it essentially turns less than one time in the economy. And yet you see the turns on the private economy, it turns 1, 1.2, 1.5 sometimes in the economy. Talk about that as an impact based on what we're talking about here with the PFD, where they retain the money to either spend for government or hold on to, or don't put it in the private economy for people to actually use.
Well, right. All you have to do is ask yourself, who's better at spending money, private individuals or government? Now, depending on your political philosophy, In other words, if you're a liberal socialist, you might actually believe that government spends money better than the individual. But that's not true, and that's not what economists find. And when I say when I use the word better, I mean more efficiently. And so the reason why there's actually a net deficit when government spends a dollar is because of the inherent inefficiencies that come with a government bureaucracy. The multiple checks that one, you know, departments have to do, the laziness that comes with sometimes, not all, but some public sector employees who are very secure in their positions. There's no doubt that money circulating through the private economy, and this is found time and time and time again, that it grows the economy at a much greater rate than government. And so that is another thing that really bothers me, is when I hear people say, well, you can't just cut your way to prosperity. And the governor has used this over and over again. Well, he's not an economist. He's a lawyer. What I would say is that actually sometimes you can cut your way to prosperity.
Right.
If you're cutting out inefficiencies, if you're cutting out duplications, if you're cutting out programs that are nice to haves and don't actually, they're not true investments that grow the private sector, then yes, you can cut your way out of a depression or a recession. It depends on what you're cutting. And the problem with this SB 26 is that it does not put any pressure on our legislature to really analyze where we are wasting money. And then that, to me, is probably the biggest issue with SB 26.
Right. Well, we've seen this same kind of political theater play out. I mean, earlier in the session, the Senate went ahead and passed a spending cap, some guidelines and guidance. And we all laughed on this program because, again, it's political theater. They've never seen a statute that they're not happy to run right over and break. And the first thing they did, of course, is they have, you know, they were even saying during the negotiations, we had Tammy Wilson on this morning. She said, yeah, they were even seeing during the negotiations, if we don't get the money from over here, we'll just tap more from the earnings reserve. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Wait, you just said that you have a fixed amount, and now you're talking about running over that amount by several hundred million dollars. That's a statute. It just doesn't matter. It becomes political theater. There is no pressure on the legislature to curb their spending or to live within their means. And you actually mentioned this in your discussion, in your article, talking about diapering the devil, because this was a common theme of what Hammond talked about. In fact, he was very upset that they just didn't zero out the income tax and that they actually took it off the books, because he said it is the only way to connect the people with the cost of their government. It's the only way to hold the legislature accountable in those regards, because otherwise they will run amok with your money.
Right. And, you know, if the people of Alaska actually had the right perspective on what the dividend is, they would be much more in tune with what their legislature is doing and how they're wasting government money.
Right.
But unfortunately, we even have Republicans, again, who consider, you know, the PFD welfare rather than, a share in this owner state. And that's part of the problem, is that the people of Alaska are very poorly educated on what the dividend actually means. And I really appreciate the work that Jim Crawford and the Permanent Fund Defenders are doing, because that is educating people.
Right.
And that's what we need, is we need people to understand, you know, why they actually get a dividend. And I would like to see actually an accounting on when you get your dividend, what was taken out of your share of the state's wealth for government.
Right.
I would love to see that, you know, like on the check stub, like you would get when you make a paycheck.
Right. You would have received this $10,000 in change, but we have taken $8,100 of it and we have expended it on X, Y, and Z. I've often advocated in this program that what I think we should do is just have the royalties paid directly to every man, woman, and child in Alaska and then issue them a tax bill like other states do. And I could tell you, if you did that, it would come to a screeching halt tomorrow.
That's not a bad idea. I do wonder how much it would cost us to extract those tax dollars from people who didn't want to pay them.
But, right, right. But it would definitely be an education for nothing less. You mentioned the Republicans, and I know that in your earlier piece, when you threw your hat in the ring for the seat that was vacated by Mike Dunleavy, you talked specifically about your prior history, that you were an undeclared, that you had not. You not really participated in politics, and that you were kind of, you know, ambivalent to it. You'd be upset when something happened, but you weren't really educated and informed. But even those of us who've been watching this, and you even said it yourself, you couldn't be a Democrat, but you really had problems with the Republicans. And you look at where we got today, and I'm a libertarian, so everybody hates me. It's just the way it is. But you look at where we are today, and we got into this place under the leadership of Republican majorities in the House and in the Senate. Of course, the Democrats were in there swinging their weight around when there needed to be a CBR vote, and they cranked the budget up as well. But this is a problem that transcends party boundaries. Like you said, Republicans saying that this is a handout, that this is welfare. I mean, we really need to look beyond that kind of party boundary stuff and say what we need is we need people who will make a commitment to reduce the size and scope of government.
That's right. And, you know, I am hard on the Republicans, and I am a Republican. I'm probably more libertarian in my thinking, but it really is a two-party system. And in order to get involved to the level that I have gotten involved, you need to be a member of the party. And I will also say this, we will be always much better off. Well, shouldn't say always. Most of the time, we will be better off if we elect a Republican rather than a Democrat. In terms of fiscal, you know, policy and in my opinion, also social policy. But I'm hard on the Republicans because they have a platform that right. is actually a pretty darn good platform. Right. And as I read that, I agreed with most of it, and so that's the party that I chose. But I'm glad I did. But we need to hold all of our elected officials accountable for the choices that they make.
Yep. Well, we see a lot of talk coming out of the legislature, and I remember a couple of years ago when the ICER reports came out and they said if we want to hit a sustainable budget, then we need to reduce our spending down to this $4.1 billion mark. And everybody paid lip service to it. Everybody said, oh, yes, of course, that's what we need to do. Of course, when the rubber met the road, nobody was willing to cut their program or their pet project, and we overspent and overspent. And that number just got cranked further and further up. And then they start talking about taking the dividend, but they still care about the recession. Let's talk for a minute about the economic impacts. I had this conversation yesterday with my listeners where I was talking about people have to understand that an economy overall is based on confidence. It is based on consumer confidence. That is really the core of any stock market or economy as a whole. And what happened was in those first couple years when they took those dividends and they cut them in half, people still did get a big chunk of money. There's no doubt about it. But they were leery because now they'd received half. And that really makes them not want to spend any of their money because now there's uncertainty and there's fear that this could lead to greater and more economic crises. And so it has a trickle. It has a ripple effect. You drop the pebble in the pond and all of a sudden everybody's holding on to your money. Like you said, your neighbor, nobody's doing remodels because they were going to do it, but now they're not sure what's going to happen. They may get half a dividend. They may get a whole dividend, but that uncertainty is killing everybody. And it really has led to an even greater economic crisis in the state that is, again, been created by our legislator and this governor.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And, you know, on the national level, presidents often get credit or don't get, or they get lambasted for the overall performance of the economy. And often they don't have a whole lot to do with it.
Right.
And it's the same at the state level, except for what you mentioned, which is consumer confidence. That comes from the leader. And when leaders do not instill in their, you know, population, those who they are leading, a sense of confidence, then you will get exactly what we're getting, which is a stagnant economy. And when you, you know, combine with that, taking out cash or not taking out, or, but maybe not putting it in, this is what we have. And in the first year with click, pick, give, there were even people who gave money expecting a certain amount, and they ended up donating a much larger percentage of their dividends than they anticipated.
Right.
Because you can't change a quick to give when, you know, half your dividend's taken. It's been a real problem for the last 2 years, and it'll be a problem again this year. And that, the only way you can change that, in my opinion, at this point, is by changing the leadership.
Right.
You mentioned the budget. You know, there was one person who had a fiscal plan and continues to have a fiscal plan to put our budget back on a sustainable path.
Right.
And that is Senator Dunleavy.
Right.
And in fact, a lot of people don't realize this, but it's my understanding that the reason why he left the caucus, as well as why Senator Hughes would not vote for the budget, was because Senate leadership and they agreed to an entirely different number. And then when it came time to vote on the budget was much higher because Senate leadership was unable or unwilling to hold firm on the budget.
Right. Well, yes.
And
yes.
So it wasn't that they weren't voting on a budget that they had all agreed to. They were being asked to vote on a budget that was much higher than they agreed to.
Right. And that's what Senator Dunleavy told us on the program when he left, was that was why he got kicked out, because they refused to hold to the numbers that he had promised his constituency. And that's why he voted against the budget. It, of course, forced him on the outside. And I agree. We have leadership in this state in both chambers and in the governorship that basically is looking at Alaskans as if they're some kind of piggy bank that they can use to fund whatever special pet project or special interest that they want to do. And it's coming down to the time now where people are a little frustrated about it because they don't see an end to it. Now, we mentioned you mentioned as part of that consumer confidence is the lack of leadership. And I think that we have the governor for sure is definitely got he can wear that crown all day long. But you get over to the legislature itself, and there are no charmers or winners when it comes to showing leadership potential. We have had two big years of huge amounts of overtime and special session, completely ignoring the statutory limit that the people put in place and everything else. And now this last year, just rushing things through at the last minute, they're just not showing any leadership at all. And it leads the question, why should we send these same folks back? A, the people who got us in this position in the first place, because most of them have been there more than 8, 9, 10, 15 years. And why should we send them back when they continue to ignore the will of the people?
Well, I mean, the answer is we shouldn't send them back.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and that's the whole reason why we have primary elections. But saying that, if people, and I'll go back to something I said earlier, and I will continue to say, if people do not get involved, if they do not figure out how they personally can contribute, whether it's financially or with their time or whatever talent they have, and if people don't get involved, then we will send those same people back. When we have voter, you know, turnout rates of you know, 10%, 15%, 25%, of course they're going to, you know, these legislators who continue to make these decisions, if you keep sending them back, you're sending them a signal. The signal is, we're fine with what you're doing. So I guess we need to send them a new signal in August, which is, we're not fine with what you're doing.
Right. Absolutely. I have advocated that every politician who is available, because we have an unprecedented opportunity here. We have, out of 60 legislators, 20 House, 40, or 20 Senate, 40 House, we have 50 of them up for re-election in this cycle, which is just unprecedented. We could send a message, and I think that every elected official who's up for re-election this year should have a challenger in the primary, even those that we think are quote-unquote good guys, because I think what it does is it holds them accountable for the various votes that they've taken over the last 24 months, and it will make them stand taller if they've been able to show on the vote and shine on the vote. And if not, it will show them for their true colors. Every incumbent should have a challenger in both the primary and in the general.
Yeah, most definitely. And this idea of, oh, well, this person is a good guy, so I'm going to vote for them, we've got to move away from that. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are good guys and people who I would, you know, have a beer with. I would never want them to be my representative or
right.
senator, but they're really good guys and good gals. And that's not who we need for leadership. So what we need is we need people who understand, you know, what it means to balance a budget and who understand what the proper role of government is.
Right.
And unfortunately, we have a lot of people currently serving who don't understand that, at least from my perspective. But, you know, having said that, I also know this, that it is quite a sacrifice to serve in the legislature. And I know that, you know, I don't know that personally, but just having been involved in the process of being on the list and thinking about what that was going to do to my family and time with my children, it's not... They do deserve our respect and for their willingness to serve. But if they are not doing what a majority of their constituents want, then they need to do something else.
Yes, and I would agree with that. And quite honestly, they are compensated fairly well for what they're doing, which is, I mean, for normally, what is normally maybe a 200-day work year. They are compensated
right.
fairly adequately for what is normally 150 to 200 day work year. That's not a bad deal, and we do have to respect them for at least offering to serve. I want to put that as I'm sorry. Go ahead. You want to respond to that?
Oh no, I was just going to say I totally agree with you. I do think it's important that people understand that it's not an easy thing to do.
No. And I served in the Borough Assembly in Fairbanks, so I've been through part of these processes, and I understand that it is daunting. It can be challenging. It can put some strain on your family. There's been a lot of that there, and so, I mean, I do appreciate that. Let's set that aside for a minute, the legislature itself aside for a second, and let's talk about SB 26. You really tear into it in this article. So I guess I need to ask Todd Smolden, what is your solution for this? I mean, this is their answer. This is their answer to the quote-unquote fiscal crisis of their own making. And so what would Todd Smolden, if I gave you king for a day, give you the magic wand, what would you do to try and right the ship of state here financially in the state of Alaska? What would be your solution?
Well, a POMV on its face, you know, by its nature, is not a bad way to take a draw from an endowment account.
Sure.
You know, I know Brad Keithley. I love reading his stuff, and, you know, I'm a mental midget compared to him. He's really done a lot of great work on explaining that. But a POMV by its nature is not a bad thing. In fact, it actually does create a more stable amount of income, you know, year to year or average years to average years, however you want to do that. But the problem with the POMV as it's been presented by our legislature is that they have been unable to pin down exactly how much of that draw they would like to issue in the form of dividends
right.
and what percentage of that draw they would like to spend for government.
Right.
And so we heard numbers of 70, you know, percent for government and 30% for dividends. Well, obviously that moves away from the traditional 50-50 payout that was envisioned by Hammond. And quite frankly, we've had a system in place for over three decades that has worked pretty darn well.
Right. Right. Well, and I agree with you. I think the POMV is, I mean, it has, the problem with the POMV as it sits now is that it has no sideboards. It has no caveats.
Exactly.
It has no restrictions. They can just
exactly.
do whatever they want to it. And that's the problem. POMV inherently in and of itself can be a good thing, but you have to have those restrictions. And this legislature, based on past performance, it shows that it has no self-control on those restrictions. And that's what terrifies me.
Right. And, you know, the constitutionalization of a dividend check is certainly a hot button issue in our state right now. And there's a lot of good arguments both against constitutionalizing the permanent fund dividend check. But there's also a lot of good arguments for it, which is that especially if you did that with a PRMV and a 50-50 split, you would be putting those, you know, guardrails on the legislature in terms of how much it could spend. Right now, just as a statute, as you mentioned before, you know, this legislature, and we'll have a different one this next session, hopefully. People are obviously moving out, but
right.
But this legislature in the past has proven that a statute is can be ignored. So it has to be somehow constitutionalized, or at least put in a form where the legislature can't just willy-nilly decide year to year what they want to do with the money that's drawn from the earnings. Now, you know, what would I do to fix the fiscal crisis? We cannot continue to add 8% to our operating budget every year.
Right.
It's completely unsustainable.
Right.
This is the part I don't understand, is that, and that's what I wrote in my article, is that without a reasonable discussion and taking the time to figure out what it means to spend efficiently and what are the essential functions of government in our state, we will just continue to grow government, and eventually the permanent fund dividend will be gone, and eventually there will be an income tax in place, and eventually we will drive business out of the state and people out of the state because government has grown to a point that it is completely unsustainable. And so we can't grow government at 8%.
Right.
Quite frankly, I believe there is still fat to cut in the operating budget. I think there's quite a bit of fat to cut, but you certainly cannot grow government by 8%.
I'm not an economist, and I can figure out that 8% compounding on a yearly basis is terrifying. I mean, I could do the math on that pretty easily with a spreadsheet and figure it out. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that. And yet that's the road that they have been leading us down year after year, is that we're just going to increase. And I think you touched on an important point here just a second ago, talking about essential services. And these are services that are mandated by the Constitution. I mean, looking at government, and like I said, you've just been really involved in this deeply for the last 18, 24 months or so. But, you know, can you see just by looking at government and at the budgets, I mean, what kind of percentage do you figure of the services that we are providing right now in this state are nice-to-haves versus the must-haves, the requirements, the constitutionally mandated requirements? What kind of percentages are you thinking there?
Oh, boy, that's tough right now to come up with a number there. But instead of that, let's just, you know, paint some word pictures here.
Sure.
Or just think about this a second. So, you know, education is a constitutional mandate in
sure.
our state.
Right.
And K-12 education and university education are, I believe, about a third of our overall budget. Now, the mandate is to provide education, equal education for people,
right.
for students and our K-12 students in our state. There's no mandate to spend $300 million on a new sports complex at UAA.
Right, absolutely.
There's no mandate for that.
Right.
And by the way, you also put the Sullivan Arena out of business.
Right.
So now the
right.
municipality of Anchorage is going to have a big
right.
Arena sitting there doing nothing.
Right.
You know, these are, it's not necessarily the departments per se. It's how money is spent within those departments. And this is why we need a different governor.
Right.
We need a governor who is going to force departments to really take a good look at their budgets and make them do some prioritizing.
Right.
And if they don't, then that governor can use the power of his veto pen in our state, which is that is one of the great things about our governor. And hopefully a new governor will use the power of his veto pen to cut out inefficiencies in departments rather than taking money from the citizens.
Absolutely. Todd Smolden is our guest. We want to wrap things up here. Todd, I appreciate you taking the time out to sit with me and discuss these things. Let me hit you with my last component. I have a thing that I've been working on for the last few years that I have dubbed my Charter of Changes. And this, to me, is the way to try and bring Alaska back from the brink, to save it for our future children. And there are four simple choices. These are four simple things that we could do. I mean, they're simple in explanation, but they will be complex in execution. The one thing in the Charter of Changes, the first and foremost, is to change the players. And I think you and I have agreed on that. We need to change the leadership. We need to change the governor. We need to change the legislators out and not send the same people back. What say you?
Oh, most definitely. I am very vocal in my support of Senator Dunleavy, and not just because he was my senator, but because he has he understands how wealth is created in an economy, and he has an understanding of what the size of our government needs to be. And he's been involved in the process, so he understands the legislative process. And Scott Hawkins, the other major contender in the Republican race, is also he's a very good guy, and he understands business. I just think that Senator Dunleavy would make a better choice in that race. But most definitely, the governor needs to be changed, and I'm doing everything I possibly can to make that happen.
Right. And I agree. I think we also need to change the leadership and the players in the legislature as well, because we're seeing the same kind of thing over and over again and expecting different results. The second change is change the venue. And by that, I'm not talking about moving the Capitol or anything else. I'm talking about changing the legislative session and holding the session on the road system in Wasilla, in Anchorage, somewhere where the vast majority of people in the state of Alaska, well over 80%, who can access a road system and come down and actually talk to their legislators, can actually attend the hearings in person, can stand in a room as a grumpy group of people and shake their fists at their legislators and show them when they are doing the wrong thing. The legislature is just too isolated down in Juneau physically and emotionally from what's going on with the state. They're completely walled off. We need to get this legislative session on the road system by changing the venue. What do you say?
Yeah, I'm in total support of that, just not anywhere. You can put it anywhere except Willow.
Anywhere except Willow, not in my backyard. You're a NIMBY guy. I see that. You're a NIMBY guy. I see. No, and I understand that for sure. The third one is changing the rules. And by that, I mean the legislature created rules for every other elected body in the state, city councils, borough assemblies, planning commissions, even down to little lowly road service area commissions with two or three people on them, that said you can't meet in secret. You must post your meetings. You must hold these meetings in public. It's called the Alaska Open Meetings Act. And then they exempted themselves from those same rules. And now they can hold private meetings, caucuses. They can discuss bills, make backdoor deals where nobody sees anything until somebody steps out on the floor and votes a bill up or down. They also have the conflict of interest rules, where everybody else would have to declare themselves conflicted out and not be able to vote on it. The legislature give themselves an out, saying, I have a conflict. Anybody could object about me having a conflict, and now I can vote and discuss bills that would directly affect my industry, my employer, and effectively affect my pay. And then the third rule that needs to change is the binding caucus. We have talked, that is an absolute abortion. It does not need to be in our legislature. There's no other bodies that I can find in the states, including the Congress on down, that utilizes a binding caucus anymore. You want to get together and vote in a block, fine, but don't have it be binding. Those three rules need to change for things to really change in Juneau. What's your thoughts?
Oh yeah, I am totally on board with what you're saying here. And number the caucus rule, I understand the reason for it, but quite frankly, the last few years, and the reason being that if you don't have a caucus, then on the floor, then you get a whole bunch of amendments, and it's really difficult to, you know, stop the pork barrel spending and the log rolling. That's the log rolling is the, you know, political term used that happens because everybody wants to add, you know, their thing to the legislation or the budget. I get the reasoning, but quite frankly, it hasn't proven to really be effective because we continue to have budgets that are far too large for what we can afford.
Right.
Not only that, but it's almost as if it's extortion. That, you know, you have your staff taken from you if you don't follow it. You get a smaller office.
Right.
You get kicked out of your committee assignments. I mean, basically, you disenfranchise, if you're a senator, about 35,000 people when a senator chooses to leave the caucus because they don't want to vote for a bloated budget.
Right.
I mean, it needs to change. In terms of conflict of interest, are you going to call this the Adam Wall rule?
I could call it the Adam Wall one. I could call it the Peter Bacicki one. I could call it the Paul Seaton bill. All of these guys have pushed and voted for, and in some cases been the deciding vote on bills that directly affect their industry and save them or make them tons of money.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. And, you know, quite frankly, I would love to be a fly on a wall in some of these caucus meetings. So as far as an open meetings, I totally agree with you. It's really frustrating when a person on the Waco board, the Willow Area Community Organization board, can't meet with two other people to discuss something because they might violate open meetings laws.
Right, and get the book thrown
at them. And you can have 21, you know, House Democrats get together and push each other and connive and do everything they need to do in order to make the right choices on the floor. I mean, yes, I total agreement with you on those three.
The fourth change is this is kind of a wish list. I don't know if we could ever get it done, but I get tired of watching what happens in the budgetary process from the governor, where he makes a decision that oil is going to be X number of dollars next year, and he bases his budget off this. I criticize Sean Parnell heavily for this in his last year in office because oil, before he dropped the budget on everybody in December, oil had already plummeted and had been down for quite a while in the 70, mid-70s, low, you know, $80 range. And he put together a budget and presented a budget that was based on oil being $117 a barrel. And to me, that's craziness right there. What I'm suggesting is, as you mentioned before, the permanent fund formula has worked out pretty well for the last three decades. Why don't we create a funding mechanism for the state that basically you build a budget based on the last 5 years of revenue? It's an average of the last 5 years of revenue. That's what you say your next budget is going to be based on that, because it will even out the highs and the lows. Like you said, when we've got lots of money, it won't allow us to spend quite all of it. And when we have less money, we won't be scrambling quite as hard to fill out those deficits. I think we could take that same PFD rolling average formula and apply it to the foundation of our budgetary process and make things a little bit easier in the state. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a great idea, and it would actually eliminate some of the, you know, when we have the booms and the busts, some of the extra spending that takes place when we have the booms. You know, other people have also talked about zero-based budgeting,
right?
Which I think would be something else that we should seriously consider, and maybe even additionally add some kind of forward funding, or making a budget multiple budgets.
Right.
More than one budget. In a year. Quite frankly, what I would like to see is I'd like to see Alaska go to the system that Texas has, where the legislature only meets once every 2 years.
Right.
I mean, imagine how much less damage they could do if they only met once every 2 years.
I see you're a fan of Samuel Clemens. I totally agree with that. That's the only time I'm ever afraid is when the legislature's in session. Well, it looks like you're on board with the charter of changes, which means that you're pretty good egg in my book. Todd Smolden has been our guest. Todd, I really appreciate you taking the time out today. I appreciate what you're writing there in Diapering the in Must Read Alaska in your article about Diapering the Devil in SB 26. Appreciate you coming on, and I'd like for you to keep in touch with us. If you got anything new you want to talk about, please don't hesitate to drop us a line and chat with us. Love to have you back on the program to talk about it more in the future.
Well, definitely do that, Michael, and thank you for all that you do and your radio show and being active and getting people motivated, because, you know, that's really the message that I want to give people is nothing's going to change if you don't get involved. So I hope people find a way to get involved over the next few months to make some changes in our state.
All right, Todd Smolden, thanks very much. Hold on 1 second. We'll be back with more of The Michael Duke Show, your home for common sense, liberty-based, free thinking, thought, and discussion.
Whoa, buddy. Put that thing back in its holster. We haven't gone anywhere.
I don't understand.
Check out themichaeldukesshow.com for information on how to get access to the podcast.
Well, thanks for coming back to us, The Michael Duke Show, your home for common sense, liberty-based, free-thinking thought and discussion. We are out of time for today. I've got a recording session that I already set up earlier. It's going to take place here in a few minutes, even though I got started late this morning. Great conversation with Todd Smolden. Look forward to having him back on the program. And quite honestly, I look forward to him potentially maybe being part of the solution in the future in running for office and talking about those things. Thanks for coming in. Don't forget tomorrow's Firearms Friday. working on a couple guests. I don't know who I'm going to have on yet. I really don't. It's just one of those days. We'll see. I may be just me chatting for 2 hours. Although I did have an interesting conversation on Facebook with Jeff Landfield of the Alaskan Landmine. We might see if we can get him on the program to talk about firearms. He has some interesting input, and I think he has some valid questions as a kind of a non-gun guy. I've been working on trying to get him on the program. We'll see if we can bring him on to talk about it. Appreciate you coming on board and talking with us today. Please drop me an email if you'd like. You can shoot me an email, me@michaeldukeshow.com, me@michaeldukeshow.com. I would love to hear from you. You can message me on Facebook here as well through the show page. Now, again, don't forget, if you want to see everything that we're doing here on the show page, and I just kind of really discovered this yesterday. My wife and I were talking. Again, I mentioned this earlier that, you know, she's like, I like the show page. I mean, she said, I've liked the page, but I don't always see everything you post. So to make it simple and easy, all you have to do is go out to my show page, and I can't show it to you on my show page, so I'm going to show you on a page, another page that I've liked. But you could see here that they've got the like section here where, you've liked the page, right? So I'll unlike it. You've got to like the page. And then you go over here to where it says following, and it says in your newsfeed right here. It says right here in your newsfeed. Instead of default, tell it you want to see it first. And that means you should see every post that I put up. Now, I only put up about 3 posts a day, one of them being this live show. When it starts, that's a post. I also post the audio-only podcast link to SoundCloud. That's my second post. And usually once a day I post an interesting news story or an opinion piece, maybe twice a day, but usually never more than that. So there's only 3 or 4 posts a day. Your feed is not going to be inundated. But again, you've got to like the page, then you've got to go to following and click see first on that, and that will give you everything that I have on my page. You can also go over to michaeldukeshow.com, and when you get there, you could see the links for, if you have an iPhone, you can click on iTunes, an Android device, you can use the Google Music Play, or you can use SoundCloud's app, or you could use the Stitcher or CastBox app, or you could just stream it from our website by clicking on podcasts at the top of the page. And look at that. You got all the podcasts from the last, well, pretty much forever. You could take a look and you could scroll through all the podcasts, and they are they're ascending in the newest podcast first. So here's yesterday's podcast right there. Simple and easy. It's how you do it. I appreciate you coming on board and joining us. Thanks for coming in. Again, drop me an email if you'd like. Me at MichaelDukeshow.com. M-E at MichaelDukeshow.com. Love to hear from you. Any thoughts, any commentary on the show, criticisms, whatever. We'll take it all in and we'll talk about it. Appreciate you being part of the program. We are out of time. It is what it is. Time to hit it hard. And time to get things out there and rolling. Again, don't forget tomorrow is Firearms Friday. We'd love to hear from you on all this and more. Just tune in. Make sure you tell all your firearms friends, too, that we're going to be doing that, will you, as well? That'll be good stuff. The Michael Duke Show continues tomorrow right here on your home for common sense, liberty-based, free-thinking thought and discussion. The Michael Duke Show, heard on Facebook Live every morning and live around the world at MichaelDukeshow.com.
Streaming live every weekday morning on Facebook Live and MichaelDukeshow.com.